Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Michael Zweibel, registration number 14376. I represent the appellant and petitioner in this matter, Shane Taylor. For the first 2.5 years of MW's life, Shane Taylor was the only father he knew. And that was the way MW knew it to be, right up until the time the trial court order in this case abruptly removed Mr. Taylor from MW's life. The question in this case, put simply, is whether the trial court is permitted to ignore this relationship when it allocates parenting time. Relevant case law says it may not. MW is not property. He is a child with an interest in maintaining relationships with the attachment figures in his life. A long line of Colorado cases recognizes the harm that comes from severing relationships with psychological parents, and social science research, as the amicus brief helpfully pointed out, supports this view. And so in CA, the leading case in this area, the court developed a standard that recognizes, on the one hand, the Troxell special weight requirement, but that also takes into account the child's interest, and that's the words of the case, in maintaining relationships with significant persons other than the biological parents in the child's life. The court must consider whether the best interests of the child require continuing the relationship with the third party, and must determine whether these interests outweigh the parental presumption. The problem here is that the trial court did not do that. It did not conduct the required analysis. It misapplied the law, it misunderstood the law.
And counsel, so, excuse me for interrupting.
Of course.
The trial court made kind of a summary ruling on the Rule 59 motion, in which it seemed to indicate that it did consider the best interests of the child. Do we go beyond that statement?
I think you do, Your Honor, because the court, there is nothing in the original order for the court to say in a summary fashion in a Rule 59. The Rule 59 motion essentially invited the court to conduct this analysis that I'm talking about, and the court refused to do that. Essentially, the court said, I was right the first time, and I did consider it in a summary fashion, said that. But I don't think we can just take that at face value, because there is no analysis. There's no analysis of what the child's interests are, what the relationship entailed for the child, what it would mean to the child to sever that relationship. None of that occurred in this case. And so I think that summary statement in a basically off-the-cuff ruling on a Rule 59 motion is insufficient to satisfy, I think, the very clear legal requirements. Because, in fact, if you look at the original ruling, it's clear that the court gave no consideration to the child's best interests. The court made no findings as to whether the child's best interests required continuation of the relationship. And I would say also, in answer to your question, Judge Miller, that the bald statement, I considered the child's best interests, even if taken at face value, is insufficient, because the court has to consider whether these interests outweigh the parental presumption. The court just didn't do any of that. Instead, what the court did was the court focused solely on the fitness of the biological parents. The court found that the fitness of the biological parents was dispositive. That was legal error. That shows how the court misunderstood the legal standards here. The court made two findings only in determining parental responsibilities. One, that the parents were fit, and two, that the biological parents were not likely to make decisions contrary to the child's best interests, which is just another way of saying the parents are fit, that fit parents, in general, make decisions in their child's best interest. But that's not the question. Fitness isn't the question. General decision-making isn't the question. The specific question the court is required to answer that it never did is whether the particular decision by the parents to deny parenting time to the third parties or third party is in the child's best interest.
Isn't there something even beyond that? The court has to make, as I understand it under the law, has to consider that, but then doesn't it also have to consider whether in fact it is in the best interests of the child to give the non-parent parental responsibilities?
Absolutely, and I don't think the court considered that either. Although frankly, I think the second and third questions, as a practical matter, probably bleed into each other. If the parental decision to deny parenting time to the third party is not in the child's best interest, it would generally seem to follow that it is in the child's best interest to have parenting time.
But not, maybe not necessarily.
Not necessarily. And so that's why I think the Supreme Court separated them out into two separate questions. I tend to talk about them shorthand as being the same question, but I recognize that there are two separate questions.
Counsel, excuse me for interrupting. Let me ask you this question. How do we reconcile your argument that the court had to go further in making these two findings that you mentioned, that the parents are fit, the biological parents are fit, and they're not likely to make contrary decisions contrary to the child's best interest, with the passage in Troxell that says, so long as a parent adequately cares for his or her children, i.e. is fit, there will normally be no reason for the state to inject itself into the private realm of the family to further question the ability of that parent to make the best decisions concerning the rearing of that parent's children.
I actually think it can be reconciled very easily, because the passage in Troxell that said there would normally be no reason to question the decisions of fit parents, essentially, is what gives rise to their special weight requirements. It's because of that general principle that we have the special weight requirement, which is then reflected in the presumption that is set up in CA and BJ. And so fitness gives rise to the presumption, but fitness is not dispositive. If fitness were dispositive, we wouldn't have the test in CA. We wouldn't have the test in BJ. The only test would be, are the parents fit? And so I think that what happened here is that the court thought fitness was dispositive, when in fact fitness is nothing more than the prerequisite to the presumption. But then, once the presumption arises, you then must consider the second and third questions that Judge Loeb referred to earlier, whether it's in the child's best interest to continue the relationship with the third party, whether it's not in the child's best interest for the parents to deny that relationship.
I can understand what you're saying and agree that that gives rise to the presumption, that fitness gives rise to the presumption. But this passage from Troxell seems to go back even a little further than that and indicate that as long as the parents are fit, there's normally no reason for the state to even inject itself into the family's life. So that seems to be a more basic statement about the state staying out of the family's life as long as the parents are fit than the presumption that later arises.
You're right. I don't know what to say about that, except that when it says there's normally no reason for the state to inject itself, that's why you have the presumption, so that the state injecting itself will only occur when a presumption can be overcome by clear and convincing evidence. That confines the intervention of the state to relatively few cases, and I think this is one of those cases where we have a long-standing psychological parent relationship, where the parental responsibilities evaluator indicated that Mr. Taylor was a primary parent for this child, that the child would be harmed from being separated from Mr. Taylor. And so I do think that that passage is not inconsistent with granting Mr. Taylor parenting rights in this time under the CA, in this case, under the CA and BJ tests. And I guess I should mention also that the presumption that arises for fit parents, and I don't want to talk too much about my second argument regarding Mr. Day and whether or not he gets a presumption, but I think the court needs to consider whether there is a presumption at all for Mr. Day under the Lair case and under the DIS case. But that's really all I want to, I don't want to beat that particular issue, because I really think this case can be decided on the basis that this trial court simply failed to apply the law, simply misunderstood the law. I mean, here's what the court said. This court could only grant parenting time to Mr. Taylor if it found that Ms. Wamscher and or Mr. Day were unfit parents or that they would not make parenting decisions that were in MW's best interests. It's on page 5 of the ruling. And so the court erroneously believed it was powerless to consider the child's best interest, that it was powerless, despite CA and BJ, to consider whether the child had an interest in maintaining his relationship with Mr. Taylor, and that's clearly an erroneous view of the law.
Mr. Zweibel, let me ask you a practical question, a remedy question.
Of course.
If this division were to agree with you on the law, what are you asking for? What's the remedy here?
We're asking for a remand to the trial court to properly apply the law. We certainly can't ask this court to make factual findings.
On the existing record?
On the existing record, yes.
And not anything beyond that?
I would not suggest that the court should go beyond that, because the court should determine whether at the time of the hearing it was in the child's best interest to have a relationship with Mr. Taylor. I understand what the court's getting at. Time has passed. It was February when the parents, the biological parents in this case, said to Mr. Taylor, you're never seeing him again. And it is now August. But there are reconciliation therapies. There are reunification therapies that can be conducted. This is not, this court has graciously expedited this case so that we've done this case in a very short period of time for precisely this reason. I think, so that the court's erroneous ruling does not become a fact that can't be overcome. And so I would suggest that it should be done on the record as the court had it. I want to make a couple more comments. Well, let me one more comment, because I want to save a little time for rebuttal. I really want to make this clear, that this is not a zero-sum game. Granting Mr. Taylor parenting rights doesn't mean that Ms. Wamscher loses any rights, and it doesn't mean that Mr. Day is not going to be involved in MW's life. Nobody loses their rights. A ruling in Mr. Taylor's favor will simply ensure that all of the important people in MW's life get to play a role in his life, and that MW, if he's a lucky child, will have the benefit of having all of these people in his life, and that is what we're asking ultimately to happen. And I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Zweibel. You've got a little over 2.5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good afternoon. Nathan Madison on behalf of the Pelley, Trista Wamscher. Nathan Madison, registration number 38627. This case is about interfering with the day-to-day decisions of a parent. Troxell, the longstanding Supreme Court case, held that this is a fundamental liberty interest and that the courts cannot interfere generally. And Colorado has refined this into, refined the Troxell decision into a three-part test, where basically you first give a presumption to a fit parent that their decision is in the best interest of the child. Now that best interest presumption can be rebutted. And the way to rebut that presumption is by proof of clear and convincing evidence that the decision of the parent is not in the child's best interest.
Now, in the case of the court didn't have that in its process, though, did it? In this case.
Well, Your Honor, it did not explicitly say that, although I believe when it was saying that it had to adhere to the decision and wishes of the parent, it was saying that that Mr. Taylor had not presented evidence that that showed that there was that it was highly likely that the parent's decision were not in the child's best interest.
Where does he say that?
I believe it's implied in where the court states in accordance with the statute and case law, this court could only grant parenting time to Mr. Taylor if it found that Ms. Whamshire and or Ms. Day were unfit parents, or that they would not make parenting decisions that were in Mason's best interest. Based on the testimony heard and the evidence presented, the court cannot do so.
He says, would not. He's not, I mean, he never says this decision of the parents is in the child's best interest. I mean, I don't see that anywhere in the court's ruling.
I'm sorry, could you repeat the question?
Does the court ever say, I find by clear and convincing evidence that the parent's decision to keep the kid away? So doesn't he have to make that kind of finding to go by the test outlined in CA?
No, the presumption is that the parent's decision is in the best interest. It's Taylor's job to overcome that presumption.
I know.
And he never made a finding, is what he said.
Where does the court say that Mr. Taylor failed by clear and convincing evidence to overcome that presumption?
Well, again, I think it's implied in the statement I just read. As I mentioned earlier, for Mr. Taylor to succeed, he'd have to show by clear and convincing evidence that the decisions to restrict his parenting time was not in the child's best interest. The evidence before the trial court, I believe, did not support such a conclusion. The court concluded
the evidence. Excuse me, counsel.
Yeah.
The evidence before the court could not have supported such a conclusion. Didn't the PRE testify that it would have been in the child's best interest to be with Mr. Taylor, that he would be the primary person, the person with primary parental responsibility?
Yes, the PRE isn't subject to the confines of the Constitution in making this recommendation, whereas the court is. The court did determine the parents were fit, and as Justice Hoffman noted, being a fit parent is a significant conclusion. There are cases where a court has determined a parent's fit just by simply passing on or giving his or her full responsibilities to somebody else. But this is not the case with my client, Ms. Whamshire. She was active in the child's life, the sole parent his entire life. So when you conclude a parent is fit, you're concluding that the parents provided the appropriate nurturing and that they're protecting and meeting the adequate needs of the child's physical, emotional, and mental needs. So it is a very pertinent conclusion that the child, that the mother was determined to be fit and that Mr. Day was determined to be fit. I believe Mr. Taylor misrepresents the conclusion that the trial court concluded that because of fitness, they couldn't overcome or couldn't rule contrary to Mr. Day or Mrs. Lancher's parenting time recommendations. But what was involved, excuse me one second. What was involved in concluding that the two parents were fit was that the conclusion of parents fit and also the conclusion that, or the analysis for the best interests of the child are very similar. They all interject and they all sort of overlap. So
DA seems to say that, well, they may overlap, they are different. I mean, they're different parts of a three-part test.
Well, they are different. I certainly would not suggest that they're not different. My point, though, is that it is a significant conclusion and you cite maybe a lack of more thorough findings. And I think that the conclusion that the parent is fit implicates that they did make certain findings with respect to fitness, which could just as easily be applied to the conclusion as to the parents acting in the child's best interest.
How do we know that if the trial court didn't make those findings? I mean, don't we need factual findings on that test? I mean, how can we even review this without those kinds of findings?
Well, you know, as I mentioned earlier, I think that the trial court made those findings. You know, like when they talk about that they they conclude that it's likely that the parents are going to act in the child's best interest, I think the term likely could just be interchangeable with presumed. And what they're talking about there is that since the parents are deemed fit, they may have to presume that they're acting in the child's best interest. And again, Mr. Taylor has the burden then of presenting evidence that their decisions are not in the child's best interest.
I couldn't agree more. And so where are the findings on what you just said? I mean,
I would submit that I think they are implied in, again, the statement I read earlier in the order.
Which you said equates to a finding that there's this presumption, and I agree. But where's the rest of it? Where's the analysis on the rest of the test? I mean, if all we're saying is that the presumption ends the day, I mean, that's not the law, is it?
No, but all the court has to do is present some indication in the record that pertinent facts were considered with respect to the best interest standard. And they talk about what the parents' intentions are and wishes are, and that's one of the factors. And they also discuss the child's interaction with the parents, and that's another factor. Again, they could have been more thorough, but I don't feel as though that they were deficient to a degree that would require the case getting remanded back to the trial court.
If we were to remand to the trial court, as suggested by Mr. Zweibel, and I'm not saying that's the case, but if we were to do so, what would you propose as far as what the court should do on remand? Should we have a new hearing? Should we rely on the present record, or what would you
propose? I think you would have to have a new hearing.
And why?
Circumstances have changed. For one thing, the child and Mr. Taylor, they have not had a significant interaction. I don't believe they've had any interaction.
But that's at the request. That's because that's what your client decided, correct?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
That's what your client decided, that they cut off all contact between Mr. Taylor and the child, correct?
Well, whether my client decided to do that or not, it still doesn't have any impact on what the effect is on the child. And that's what's going to be pertinent there, is to determine what's in the best interest of the child, his psychological, mental, emotional well-being.
And so is it your, if you had this new hearing, and Mr. Zweibel wanted to introduce evidence that your client did cut off all contact between the child and Mr. Taylor, is that evidence admissible or not, in your opinion?
I'm not prepared to answer that.
I know. Okay.
Another contention I want to address real quick is Taylor's position that somehow being a psychological parent gives the court should consider some sort of special weight to that. I think he misrepresents what the CA holding stated. What CA addressed was the court's conclusion, the appeals court's conclusion, that to overcome the presumption of a parent, the non-parent had to show that the parent's plan presented or threatened emotional harm to a child that was substantial. The court in CA said no. They said no, you just have to prove that either the parent is unfit or that the determination is not in the best interest of the child, which is the standard today. It doesn't etch out any special weight for psychological parents. In fact, there's a case out there that says that a psychological parent might not even have standing. So to make this jump would be a bridge too far. It's also, the General Assembly hasn't explicitly stated anything to suggest that a psychological parent should have that sort of authority or ability to intercede with a parent's constitutional right. Also, if you were to provide that some sort of special weight for psychological parents, it'd be implicit that you're then diminishing the right of the actual parents. If everyone's special, then no one's special, and everybody will be put on equal planes, and there's no way that that the parents' constitutional right could be adequately protected. I'd ask to reserve the rest of my...
You don't have reserved time. You get 15 minutes, so you can keep talking for 3 and a half, or not.
I will, if you guys can stay awake. Another case I want to discuss was EMC, which I think the court, Taylor discusses in both his opening brief and his reply brief. The facts there are clearly distinguishable. In that case, the parent participated in filing for joint custody. It was two women who had jointly adopted a child from China. They were a couple for 11 years. This is a case, is a great example of the rare circumstances where where a party who's a non-parent should be permitted to interject or override a parent's decision-making rights. Also, in that case, the child had attained a non-parent's name. They had the non-parent was named in the school's listing as the mother. She had access to the had authority through the doctor to make certain recommendations. So that case is clearly inapplicable to the circumstances and matters here. Also, in Mr. Taylor's brief, he makes the argument that Ms. Lamshire somehow diminished or abdicated her rights by having a relationship with him and letting him be a part of her life. Now, he was her boyfriend, and they lived in the home, and the home wasn't just their home. There's two other gentlemen who lived there. But the recent case, In Re BRD, which is a 2012 case, that recently stated that, in that case, a third-party couple had exercised sole decision-making and the vast majority of parent time under a court order. And there the court said that a parent who sought to intercede with that court order of the non-parents still was to be afforded full constitutional rights as that parent. For the reasons stated in the brief and the oral argument today, I ask the court to affirm the trial court's decision, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Madison. By Bell, you've got...
Your Honor, I am here representing the intervener, Mr. Day. He also appeared and briefed this issue.
Well, I don't... How much time do they have left? 40 You've got... If you want to say something, you come up. You've got 48 seconds, but each side has 15 minutes total.
Your Honor, there are three parties in this case, though.
Well, the rules are that each side has 15 minutes. If you wanted to split your time some way, you should have advised us.
Very well. In terms of the court's determination, Judge Butler made some detailed factual findings. Judge Butler then concluded that applying the statutory and constitutional evidence or standards and the evidence of the case, that number one, he couldn't conclude the parents were unfit. Number two, he couldn't conclude that they were making decisions not in their child's best interest. At that point, we get to an issue of weighing the evidence. And is or is not the court required to give more weight to Mr. Taylor's involvement up to that point in the child's life? And we don't get to reverse on appeal on the trial court's decision weighing that evidence. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Zweibel, you've got a little over 2.5 minutes for any rebuttal you would like.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have one thing to say, which is that this is not a case about assessing the weight of the evidence. This is a case about misapplication of the law, the court's erroneous view of the law, and that's the basis on which we're asking for reversal. Beyond that, I'll waive the rest of my time unless there are further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Zweibel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to all counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted. Division will issue an opinion in due course. That concludes